Your favorite PGA and LPGA legends, pros and top instructors are right here every week on Next on the Tee. Join Chris as the greats of the game share their stories, insights and playing lessons. Now, back to Chris and more of the show.
All right, now joining me here to help us continue to celebrate our 200th episode on the French Lick Resort guest line is Class A teaching professional Greg Ducharme. Let me give you a little bit background on Greg. He is from Rexford, New York, which isn't far from Schenectady in Albany. He graduated from Coastal Carolina University with a degree in professional golf management. He's a Class A professional teaching at the Michael Breed Golf Academy at Trump Golf Links at Ferry Point, which is just outside of New York City. You can hear him on Michael Breed's show, A New Breed of Golf, every morning from Monday through Friday from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Sirius XM. I listen every morning on my way to work, and I'm very excited that Greg has taken some time to join me here tonight on Next on the Tee. Hey, Greg, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Congratulations on your 200th show. What an honor it is to have me join you on there. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. So, Greg, I want to start off our time with you tonight by going back to when you were a kid, because being from that part of the country, I have to imagine there were a lot of competing sports for your attention, including hockey. Talk about growing up and the different sports that you played and when golf entered your life.
Absolutely. So golf was a thing that I wasn't very interested in. I had very little to even no interest in golf. And the competing sport you mentioned, ice hockey, I played that from the age of 5 all the way until I graduated high school. I was 18 years old when I hung up the gates there, and I decided to go to college down in South Carolina, and that was kind of a turning point for me. I decided hockey wasn't going to take me very far. I could play golf for a whole lot longer, and I thought it would be better for me. I didn't start playing golf until I was a sophomore in high school. So I was playing ice hockey. I loved it. I was playing I was playing travel hockey, and God bless my parents. So we were playing 80 game seasons, and that was just in the wintertime. In the summertime, I was doing camps, and I was playing on travel teams, just basically tournament teams. And I played for a team from New Jersey, living in Albany. That's a long way, but in the summertime, there's no practice. It was just basically we would travel to Toronto and Quebec City and all over the place, Connecticut and New Hampshire and Marlboro, Mass. We were traveling all over the place for all of these hockey tournaments. And I thought golf was kind of lame. Honestly, I was not into it. I thought it was boring. I thought it was slow. I thought it was a sport for old men. And all of a sudden, there was in the fall time, my dad and I would watch football, one of my favorite things to do. And every once in a while, he would flip over to the golf on Sunday. And it's like, Dad, it's football time. Why are we flipping over to golf? And all of a sudden, this guy wearing a red shirt and a Nike swoosh is fist pumping, and the crowds are enormous, and there's just so many people, and everybody is going nuts. And just like so many others my age, Tiger Woods is the guy that brought me to the game. And all of a sudden, just at the flip of an instant, the wink of an eye, all of a sudden, I think of golf as being a cool game. And so I go and I start, I get a set of clubs. I start hitting some balls. I realize, wow, this is really difficult and I'm not very good. And I didn't like that very much. So, you know, some of my buddies who also played hockey were taking golf lessons and getting better, and we'd go out and play, and they kept beating me. And that wasn't something that was going to work for me. So I took one lesson, I took one lesson and I learned grip, I learned ball position, and I learned a couple of basic drills on how to swing the club and how to transfer your weight. And it was basically two drills that I learned. I still remember them to this day. And from there, I learned how to hit a ball, and I learned how to make some consistent contact and get it in the air. And really, the rest is history. Now, at this point, I go to work every day, and, you know, I had one of our coworkers at the academy, Andrew Losey, he commented, he said, basically what I do is I go to work in the morning and I talk about golf on a radio show. And then I go down to the academy and I teach other people how to play golf. And then, my fiance Bridie took a video of me. I was in the living room late one night, just making golf swings, because, and he saw it and said, man, you, when you get home at night, you're working on your own game in the living room. And that's basically what my life has turned into, from hockey all the way until now, where I wake up and I go to sleep with golf on my mind and all of my activities. So it's been a really fun ride so far.
So to that point, right? A kid from upstate New York ends up going to Coastal Carolina for professional golf management, right?
Yep.
Boy, I loved it. I fell in love with this game as a sophomore, because that's only a couple of years, right, before you're graduating, and now you're going to go off and you're going to do your thing in college. Did the bug hit hard and that was just it? Now I'm going to be a teacher of this game. How did all of that transpire?
It hit really hard, first of all. But I have a friend of mine who I also played hockey with and played golf with. He kind of brought me into the game, and his name's Kevin Schlansker. And Kevin, you don't have to try to spell that. Don't worry. But he basically said, there's this thing called the PGM program and the school of Coastal Carolina, which was in Myrtle Beach. And I had happened to vacation in Myrtle Beach every once in a while as a kid growing up. So I was familiar with Myrtle Beach. I loved going down there. I thought it was the coolest place. So I thought it was a really good fit. And the cool thing about the PGM program down there, which, also happened to be a nice selling point to my mother and father, was, hey, when you go and do this, this isn't a singular, you're not just going down there for golf management. You end up getting a business degree. My degree was in marketing, and you have a concentration in PGM. So you're going down there for a business school. All of your core classes are in our business classes, and your electives are in the golf world. So one of my electives one year was food and beverage. One year there was a swing, a golf swing, kind of a teaching course. There was a golf course architecture and design course. And these are your electives. These are things that you might take instead of, some other random elective that you may take. They were all golf related. And I thought that was pretty cool. You got a membership to a golf course. And basically all you had to do was prove your handicap. And it's since changed. I was in the last class of what's called PGM 1.0, which is named 1.0 only because 2.0 came out the year after. And when 2.0 came out, you basically had to take your PAT, which is a playing ability test. You had to take that before you could start taking your book work, before you could start taking your tests in all the individual fields that you have to go through, which I don't need to go into detail about all that. But basically, when I got there, you had to have a golf professional sign off on the fact that you were an 8 handicap or better. And at the time, in those 2 years when I really first started playing, which was really 3 summers, it was really 3 summers of play, I had gotten pretty good fairly fast. I the first year in the fall when I had with high school golf, I basically was shooting in the mid-50s for 9 holes. And I was on the team. And then my next year, I was a junior and I was still on the JV team. And I was basically shooting by that time in the low 40s. So in 1 year, I had kind of jumped 10 shots. Now, when you're shooting 55 for 9 holes, if you improve at all, it's going to be, there are significant, you improve your tee shot and you go from hitting a big slice into the woods to hitting a shot that can get into the fairway, you're going to save 10 shots fairly easily. So then I got into the low 40s, and then the next year I started getting to where I could play a little bit. And I made that, this is now my third season on the golf team. I made the varsity team, and now I could shoot in the, around a couple over par. I wasn't shooting under par or anything, but I could keep it around par. And at that point, it starts getting much more difficult to improve. Because now, it's not so much, well, I can't get the ball in play and I can't chip and I don't know how to hit certain shots. Now it's, well, how am I going to hit all these shots a little bit better? How am I going to hit them a little more consistently? It hit me hard. I got pretty good fairly fast. And again, it was fairly easy for me. Hand-eye coordination wasn't necessarily an issue. Those weren't the difficult things. The difficult things for me were just knowing what to do, which I'm still learning today, which is one of the coolest parts about my job. But basically, that's kind of how this all came to be. And going down there, I had a couple of advantages. One, I love to play golf, and my family, my parents knew that. They thought they supported it. They thought it was a really good thing and a good thing to try, with a nice backing of hey, you know, you're going down there for a business school. This isn't just purely golf. So I think that was a really nice selling point for the whole thing.
And Greg, when I was doing some research on you, I found an article online written by Richie Phillips back in May of 2012. In the article, he wrote, "I think Greg had a GPS device implanted in his head at birth. He just looks out there, he sets his eyes on the pin, and whammo, there it goes." Is that one of your strengths? Do you have a good, strong feel for what the right distance is, or is it more referring to you're an aim and shoot? There's not a whole lot of messing around and thinking about things. Select the club, set up, boom, there the ball goes.
Well, you know, back in 2012, that was a different time in my life. I hadn't quite started getting into. I knew I'd love to play. I knew the game. That was kind of when I was still a hockey player, and since then, I've started to, as I've gotten into the teaching world, I've now started working with Michael Breed, and I started watching and learning about all these new aspects of the swing. So my golf game has kind of gone through a number of phases. There was the first phase around that time, 2012 might have been a little bit pat, you know, I was starting to learn a little bit then, but basically I was just being fairly athletic, a guy that loved to play and a guy that was really a hockey player turned golf. And I guess that's where it comes from. It was just kind of a, hey, I'm going to stand up here. I'm going to look at my target. I'm going to hit it to my target because I'm an athlete. And that's what athletes do. We hit our target. And as I started to work with Michael and started to learn some of the techniques and the ways to improve, the ways to be consistent, the ways that a swing really should be, my game sort of changed. And honestly, for the first couple of years, it went through a really rough patch because I was watching, I spent my first summer after college just watching Michael give every lesson. And all he was giving lessons to all kinds of different people. He's giving lessons to tour pros. He's giving lessons to high, you know, 25 and above handicap, complete beginners, and everything in between. So when you're as young and as a person like the way that I was, I had no idea. I had no knowledge. I was just a complete sponge. And I tried all of these things in my own game. And I quickly found out that, you know, as that article pointed out, that just look, aim, shoot kind of mentality. Well, when you start thinking about the techniques of your swing, that goes away. And it goes away pretty quick. And I got to a point, I didn't really know what I was doing with my game. For a while, and it took me probably 2 years to come to get out of that and realize, learn how to understand, hey, listen, just because somebody else needs to work on this, that's different than my game. And that was a real learning curve for me. But back in 2012, that was probably after a round in an outing, and you know, they'd probably seen me play a couple of times because back in high school, I played in a high school tournament that I ended up winning and I made a hole in one. And there were some articles written about that. And the cool thing about the hole in one that I made was it was on the final hole of a tournament. And I ended up winning that tournament by one shot.
Wow.
On that hole in one. And that gives you a little bit of a GPS sort of nickname. And it was probably a fluke round more than anything. It's the only hole in one I've ever made. It's also the only tournament that I've ever won. And the two of them coming in contact together the way they did was kind of a cool thing. But around my hometown, people kind of knew my golf game based on one shot that I ever really hit. And it was all that I ever really did, especially in that area. At that point, and I think that's a little bit of where that nickname kind of comes, or that story kind of comes from.
And Greg, you come from a very athletic family. Your sister Lexi is a good athlete. Talk about her. What a tremendous gymnast I read she is.
Yeah, my younger sister Alexa, everybody calls her Lexi. She was a gymnast, similar to the way that I played hockey. She was. And think about what my parents have gone through with myself traveling to all these hockey games as I did, and my sister Alexa traveling all over the place for these gymnastics meets. And there's a little bit of a difference between going to a gymnastics meet to watch and going to a hockey game to watch. A hockey game, there's constant motion, there's excitement, every 45 seconds or so, a line is changing and I'm on and off the ice, on and off the ice. You go to watch a gymnastics meet and it probably takes 6 hours. And Alexa is competing on there for, she is actually on the floor or on the bars or on a balance beam for a total of, it might be 5 minutes, and 5 minutes might be high. So you're going there cheering on the team for a very, very small amount of time to watch her compete. But what I will say about that is the amount of time and practice that they put in between meets is incredible. And I mean, they're in the gym for hours upon end every day and they don't take a break. And it really has her gymnastics friends were always her best friends because they spent so much time together. She would get out of school and she would get the best grade. She always made me look like such a bad student. She would get the best grade and she's in the gym way more than I'm at hockey practice. Hockey practice is an hour and a half long. She's at the gym for 3 hours and she comes home and gets her homework done and gets to sleep. And she's like this perfect child. And all of a sudden she goes off to college and she goes to SUNY Brockport in Rochester, New York. And all of that hard work she put in, all of that skill that she developed led them to, in her freshman year, a national championship. And so she's got a national championship ring on her finger, something I do not have and will never acquire for any of my skills. So she's always got the athletic leg up on me. She always has. She always will. Another thing about Alexa, her hard work has always paid off. She, not only in athletics, but in academics as well. She ended up going to, Long Island University, in Brooklyn for grad school after Brockport, and she got her doctorate. She's a physical therapist now. So, very exciting for her. She's got her boards coming up in October, and she's on her way to a great, exciting career.
Ah, good for her. That's great stuff.
Yep, very exciting.
So, Greg, to finish connecting the dots in your career, how do you go from Coastal Carolina to working with Michael Breed?
Well, it's a great question. And what I would say is it's a lot of luck, but I think that it was part of it was meant to be. I've been working with Michael now for 5 years. And so six years ago now when we first met, I was working at a place called Arcola Country Club, which right now is relevant because it's the golf course right next door to Ridgewood where they're playing the Northern Trust this week. And at Arcola, one of the assistants, a guy by the name of Jeff Martins he also went to Coastal Carolina. And so I was working with Jeff and Jeff was kind of showing me around the area. I'm in now upstate New Jersey. I'm from upstate New York. I went to college in South Carolina. I don't really know anybody. I don't know how to get around. Jeff is there kind of showing me around, introducing me to people, taking me to golf courses to play. He's taking great care of me. And I had, by the way, at that internship for me was one of the best golf jobs you could ever have. And just real quick before I finish this story, I had a schedule where I'd work 10 to 6. I would work 10 to 6 every day except on I had Monday off, and on Sunday I would work 9 to 5. So if I wanted to go home somewhere, I got out a little bit early. It was as good as it gets. So I would get up and I would go to the range at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd hit ball until 10 when I'd work, and I'd basically just kind of hung out in a shop all day and quote unquote learn. And when I got done, I got out on the golf course and I played until dark. It was the best job you could have. But what I basically told Jeff is that I want to get into teaching, and teaching's really where I want to go. But at Arcola, the junior program was fairly small, so I had a little bit of experience with that, but it wasn't a really big thing. So I would spend a lot of time in the shop, and I got in trouble for this. I'm watching videos of tour pros on the computer. I'm sitting there on the computer. The other thing is the members don't have to go into the shop there to go out and play. So everyone that shows up doesn't have to go in and see you. They can just kind of go see the caddy master and head out on the course unless they want to buy something. So as the intern watching the shop, I had a lot of free time. Even on a busy day, I'm just watching videos of Adam Scott or Tiger Woods, who know, you name it, I've seen it. And I'm just watching their videos. And so one day, Jeff brings me to a place called Manhattan Woods. And we're going to play with another Coastal grad by the name of Joe Condomitti. And Joe was at the time working for Michael as his assistant. So we play, and Joe's asking me what I want to do, blah, blah, blah. And Jeff's kind of telling him, yeah, the kid just wants to teach. And at the end of the round, Joe says to me, hey, Greg, you know, I know you want to get into teaching. I'm leaving at the end of the year. I'm going to Round Hill Club, and Breed's going to need another guy. You should send a resume. I said, are you kidding? Of course. So I send him a resume. He calls me up and says, hey, why don't you come to Manhattan Woods for an interview at this time on this day? And I meet there. I dress up in a suit and tie, go down to this interview, and I'll never forget the interview. First of all, a very different interview experience than anything that I've ever had, anything that I was ever told that an interview was supposed to be like. This was not a typical kind of where do you see yourself in 10 years kind of questions. These were personal, deep questions. And the take from it was he wants to know what kind of person I am, not what kind of golf pro I am, which is wise on his part because he knows that, hey, I'm just an intern. I don't know anything. I'm basically getting this job to learn more. So I'm in the suit and tie, and Michael is asking me questions, and he's hitting some balls. I'm sitting in a rocking chair out on the range, and the sun is right in my eyes. He's hitting right into the sun, and I'm just staring into the sun. I can't really see. So I'm answering these questions, and I have tears rolling down my face because of the sunlight. I'm trying to block it out. Anyway, I get through it, and I was nervous because I thought, man, you know, I'm squinting. He's probably wondering what's wrong with me. I can't see. I'm crying. it was a mess. But he calls me a couple weeks later, says, hey, Greg, if you want, the job's yours. And here we are today, 5 years later. And I have the great fortune of being involved in his radio show, A New Breed of Golf. Get to talk about golf every morning, get to basically the hard work that I get to do when I go in. I got to do my research. I got to do my homework. I'm researching tour pros, statistics, and everything you can imagine in the world of golf. And then I get to talk about it on the air. And then I get to go help my students improve their game. So it couldn't be better.
Greg, like I mentioned at the top of the show, I listen to you and Michael every morning on my way to work, and I love the show. And the best part of the show to me, not only is just the golf knowledge and that sort of thing, but it's how upbeat and positive you guys are. So much of what we hear on
yep.
sports talk radio is ranting and raving and yelling, and I love that you guys are not that. And we try to do that as well here on this show, plus I do a show on the football side, Thursday Night Tailgate, and we, you know, we try to do the same thing there. We don't try to rant and rave and talk about all the negative things that happen. We do a spotlight on the positive segment. So we try to be positive as well. And I think that's such a huge credit to the two of you for keeping it that way. Talk about why that's so important to both you and Michael.
Well, basically that we're two coaches, and that's basically our bloodline is. That's where we come from. And when you're a coach, the negative things aren't really going to do you any good. And a lot of this, for me personally, Michael aside on this, this comes from my mother. My mother is a woman who believes that you're with your mind, you can control anything. And basically what you ask for, you receive. So if you are out there saying, well, you know, this is going to be a terrible day. This part of my day is going to stink. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. It's going to turn out being a really bad day. And whatever it is that you have to do that day is not going to end up being a very positive experience. But if you go into the day and you say, you know, for instance, I got to do laundry today. If you go into laundry saying, this is going to stink. I hate doing laundry. I can't believe I have to fold this. Then when you're doing it, it's going to stink. But if you go in there and you say, listen, I'm going to have the cleanest clothes and I'm going to smell so good tomorrow. I'm going to smell better than anybody else the next day, and I can't wait to have my new, fresh, soft sheets to sleep in tonight. And if you get excited about that, well, it's going to change your entire experience. It's going to change the way that you look at it, quite possibly your entire day. And definitely the one moment when you're doing the task that it is you don't want to do. So there, and in golf, it's the same way. So when you're coaching golf, if you say, for instance, I'll give you a little story here. Most students, when they come in and they work on a new technique or a new move in their swing, they say, well, you know, that feels weird. And we don't let our students say that's weird, because weird is really, it's a bad word. You won't, if you say, hey, try this new food, it's really weird. You've never had it before, it's really weird, but you'll like it. Well, you're not going to want to try that. I don't want to try anything weird. But if you say, hey, I got this great new pasta sauce you can try. It's really different. You've never tasted anything like it. Try it. You're going to say, oh, okay, I'll try something different. Different is good, but weird is bad. So they really mean the same. It's kind of the same thing. But what we tell our students is, hey, listen, you're here for different. And if you're doing the same thing, if what you're doing is not different, well, then it's not better. And the line is that we use this all. I use this with almost every first time student that I ever have. And it's, well, better isn't, while different isn't always better, better is always different, because the same can't be better. So by definition, if it's different, well, it's got a chance. It's at least got a chance to be better. And if you're taking a lesson, you're trying to get better, well, doing the same thing just isn't going to work. It's not going to get anything done. So you take a sentiment like doing something different, and you can look at it one of two ways. One, it's different, which means it's going to be, it has a chance to be better. The other way to look at it is, hey, this is weird. And if you look at it as weird, then you don't want to do it, and you don't want any part of it, and it's not going to be successful, and you're not going to try weird. And certainly when that student leaves the lesson tee and they go to practice on their own, if they think of that with the perspective in their mind of, hey, this is weird, well, they're not going to do it anymore. They're going to go right back to their old way. They are going to have wasted money, and I am not going to have made that student better. I haven't helped them, which is the whole purpose of doing what I do, is to help people. So the perspective in my profession and Michael's profession is incredibly important, incredibly important. And to focus on the negatives, in my opinion, is just, it's simply a waste of time. And focusing on the positives is something that can uplift your day. It can change your day and those around you. It can change their day too.
That's great stuff. Couldn't agree more, Greg. Just a couple more before we let you go. And one of the topics that you and Michael have been talking about over the last several days is the idea that tour players should get paid even if they don't make the cut. And I know Michael's big on figuring out a way, how can we divvy up this purse so the guys get paid for the time that they're spending in the pro-ams or in the clinic that they might put on, help to put on, you know, prior to the tournament, and they're entertaining the crowd at least for Thursday and Friday if they don't happen to make the cut. Give me your thought. What are your thoughts on that topic?
Well, there are certain things on the show that you'll hear that I don't necessarily always agree with Michael. And sometimes I can express that on the show. And there are sometimes where I may not have a real case in my mind. It doesn't feel right, but I don't know exactly why I may disagree. But so the moral of the story here is it's not 100% that the two of us are in the same line of thinking. There are times where we disagree, but this is one of those cases where I couldn't agree more. And honestly, we were talking about doing a great debate on it. And he said, well, can you take the other side? And I said, Michael, I don't think I can. I can't find a reason why these guys are not getting paid. To me, it's very unfair. And they're basically going out there and they're entertaining people, players, for two rounds. They're playing for two rounds. And on Thursday and on Friday, you basically have, well, you have a full field, right? So that's one thing. So because they're in the field, they've extended the day of viewing golf. And that means that there's more concession sales. That means there's probably more ticket sales. Some people on a Thursday might only be able to make it for the afternoon or for the morning. And if you cut the field, and if you had no cut, for instance, and the field was instead of being 140 players, it was only 70 players. Well, now that day is cut in half, and certain people aren't going to be able to go watch. So all of the sales that happen in the PGA Tour are now limited, and those players contribute to that. Now, here's the other thing to me that's such a big thing. The people that disagree, the biggest one that I've heard is, hey, you know, I'm a salesman and I work for a commission. Or what about a salesman who works on commission? What about a car dealer who works solely on commission? And if they don't make the sale, if they don't succeed, then they don't make any money. And my answer to that is, first of all, if you are one of the 200 or so players that has a PGA Tour card, you've made it. You've succeeded. You've made the sale. And the sale for the PGA Tour is made before Friday afternoon. The PGA Tour is selling the product, which you are contributing to as a player in the field. They have already sold that product. And without you, there's no product. There's nothing that they can sell. So to me, those guys that are out there playing, have their work has already been sold. And somebody has already made money on it, and they continue to make more money on it. And for them to get no part of that, even though they're putting in 2 days of work, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And I think I think there are a number of ways you could pay these guys. I'm not saying they need to make, you know, $10,000 every week they're out there. I'm not saying that they need to get when they get their PGA Tour card, I don't think that they need to get a certain amount of money, like say the NFL. I don't think they need to get a minimum contract, but I do think that when they go out there and play, that's entertainment. That's work that they've done. And I think that they're deserving. I think that that they have earned themselves at least something, to the point where they're not losing money on expenses. And the other point that everyone makes is, hey, well, they're getting paid by the sponsors. Their club sponsors are paying them every week that they go out there and play. And that's true. But the reason for that is the club sponsors, the club, let's say Titleist has a guy out there. Well, Titleist is getting they're making money on the PGA Tour players. They're using their product. And when Titleist can say, hey, we have 180 players on the PGA Tour playing our golf ball, or however many it is, I just completely made that number up, but we have this number of players playing our golf ball. Well, that's good for their business. And so because of that, they pay those guys. And when the PGA Tour has these guys out there playing, well, that's good for their business. And I think that those players should be compensated. And I think there are so many ways you could do it. It's not even worth discussing, really, the way. I don't think that it's a redistribution. I don't think that you take the purse and you make everybody in the purse give up 3% of their purse for the guys that missed the cut. That's not really what I think. But I think you could, I think you could take a portion of concession sales. I think you could take a portion of beer sales, right? Liquor sales. If you buy a beer, a dollar of it's going to go to a guy who doesn't make the cut, or to that purse of guys that don't make the cut. I also think that there's a potential for the PGA Tour to have a really big revenue stream coming in, a new one. Aside from the Discovery deal where they just made $2 billion for their product, which includes those players that missed the cut, I think that the gambling thing is going to potentially bring a big revenue stream to the PGA Tour. And if that brings a revenue stream to the PGA Tour, I think they could take a portion of that and pay these guys that are out there competing to make a cut, and out there entertaining fans, and out there improving the experience of the PGA Tour.
Craig, like I say, just one more here before we let you go. And I think it was, if I saw the date correctly, last year, mid-year, you were sort of on your own on the show. I think it was the first time you subbed for Michael. What was that like? What was it like kind of heading into, all right, Greg, it's your show today, my friend. Good luck.
Hey, yep, absolutely. Well, so it was actually, believe it or not, 2 years ago, back when the show was 1 hour for 3 days a week, that's when I filled in for the very first time. And it was in the middle of the season, and Michael had a shoot to do at Ferry Point. And at that time, Michael didn't have the studio up and running, and we would do our show. Again, it was 9 to 10. So we had more time to get everything prepared. Now being 8 to 10, the setup time, the amount of time that it takes to get ready for a two-hour show versus a one-hour show is a little bit different. So at that time, when it was 1 hour, we were able to just do it at the academy. And our preparation was basically we would go out, we'd hit balls on the range, and a half hour before the show started, we'd go in, set up, and talk about what we talked about. So back in that, in those days, Michael traveled with the radio, all of the stuff. He had a carry case, which we still have, but now it's pretty much stationary. And he would bring it down to the academy and we'd set it up. And because one day a week he would do it at his house on Tuesdays. He wasn't teaching on Tuesdays. So anyway, this one day happened to be a Wednesday, and he was going to bring it down, and he was going to be doing a shoot out on the range, for this DVD thing that he did. And so he's going to bring it down. I'm going to get everything set up. I was down there and I was going to do the show from our academy, like we always did. It was just going to be me. And I was prepared. I was a little nervous. I was excited. I was prepared. Well, Michael gets there, and when he gets there, he starts talking to me about some of the keys, right? And he's, the way that he is, he's talking fast. He's very excited. He's got a lot to do. This isn't just about me going on and doing a show. He's got to also prepare for the shoot. So he's kind of going over these things really fast, and all of a sudden he just looks at me with a blank stare. Mid-sentence, he just stops and he goes, "I forgot the radio," back at his house. All the way back in Connecticut, and we're in the Bronx, New York. It's probably 20 minutes away, but now all of a sudden it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and I got to go from New York to Connecticut at 8 o'clock in the morning to do my first show now at his house alone, and it's a little tight for time. So Michael is in a panic. And the whole time I'm saying to myself, just go be calm. I would say, I'll make it. Don't worry. We're going to be okay. But I got in the car and I was driving, and now I'm finally by myself, and I was trying to be calm, and I wasn't so calm anymore. I was really nervous. Am I going to make it? And I get there 15 minutes before the show. And Michael's wife, Carrie, bless her heart, was able to get everything set up for me before I got there. So I basically got there, put the headset on. I had 15 minutes to talk with our producer about what we were going to talk about. And the feeling I had was probably a feeling that you wouldn't expect. It was a very interesting feeling. I will never forget this. And whenever I tell people this, they're so surprised, because you would think that, wow, there are so many people listening. I'm so nervous. What is everybody going to think of me? But when I put the headset on, it's silent and there's no noise. And the feeling I got was like, hello, is there anybody there? Is anybody listening to me? And it was a very, very kind of surreal feeling, because when you're talking on there and you're doing your intro and there's not a phone call coming in, the producers aren't talking in your ear. They're letting you go. Those moments in between, you know, when you're trying to find your words and you're thinking about what it is that you're going to say, there's moments of silence, and it was just a very interesting feeling. I'm sure there were a number of people listening. I'm sure far fewer than if Michael was doing the show. I'm sure most people just changed the channel. But at that point, when they heard that it was me, but it was a very, very interesting sort of feeling of loneliness, which I'm sure is not what you would expect, right, Chris?
Yeah, no, I mean, to be honest with you, Greg, I do understand it, because, you know, it's just me here on the show, right?
Right.
So there's no one to bounce anything off of if there's no you, right? So
right.
Now it's just you and your thoughts. And then, yeah, it can be a very lonely feeling, very isolating, because now.
Yeah. Am I going down the right road here?
Yeah. That two or three seconds of silence seems like forever. Right.
Yep.
So then
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's a very lonely feeling. I absolutely understand what you're saying. Let our listeners know, how can they follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
So on social media, you can get me on Twitter. I'm at the real GFD. No confusion. It's the real GFD. So there's no, it's not an imposter. It's really me, I promise you. So that's how you can get me on Twitter. And then, if you were to, say, you want a little bio on me, if you were interested in coming and taking a lesson with me, you could go to michaelbreed.com, and in the academy section there, I have a profile there. And of course, what you can always do is tune into the show on Sirius XM every morning, Monday through Friday from 8 to 10. And that's Sirius 208 and XM 92. It's on PGA Tour Radio. It's a great positive listen. You know, Michael's running the show and I help him out as much as I can back there. And through that show, you can call into the show, which that's a number that I don't need to say now, but we say it all the time on the air. You can call in. We get all the listeners get involved, and everyone can weigh in on their ideas. And you can also send an email to A New Breed of Golf, which is the name of the show, at michaelbreed.com. And both Michael and I get to check that email and read your input and all your thoughts.
Well, Greg, thank you so much again for taking time out of your night to be a part of our show. And I want to give a shout out to our mutual good friend, Brian Jacobs, for getting us together so that we could have you on the
Absolutely.
Show. Brian's a fantastic
Absolutely.
Friend and a great instructor in his own right. So thank you
yes,
to Brian.
Yes.
So, Greg, take care.
Absolutely.
All the best to you and your family. Hopefully, we get the opportunity to have you come back on the show again real soon because it's been a lot of fun spending time with you. Got dozens of other questions I'd love to get you to weigh in on, so I hope you'll come back and join me sometime.
Hey, you let me know anytime you need me. I'm always here, happy to help. And what an honor to be a part of your 200th show. So congratulations on that. I hope to talk to you again soon.
All right, Greg. Thank you very much. Take care. All the best to you,
Thanks, Greg.
Your family, and to Michael. Look forward to having you back on.
Okay. Okay, talk to you soon. Have a good night.
Thanks, Greg. That is Greg Ducharme. And again, you can hear him every morning on the Michael Breed Show, A New Breed of Golf. He's fantastic on there. And what a great rise he's had up through the golf ranks. So congratulations to Greg. And I can't thank him enough for taking time out of his night to be a part of the show. It's hopefully he's a guy that we get to say years from now has been on many, many times like Mark Wiebe has.